are at the top of the hour now, so I would like to introduce our participants for today's presentation. Dr. Asma Shakout will be presenting the report findings. She is a core investigator for the Center for Chronic Disease Outcomes Research and section chief for GI section and staff physician for gastroenterology section at the Minneapolis VA Healthcare System. She's also an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and a staff physician at the Fairview University of Minnesota Medical Center. Joining us today also is Dr. Mark Helfand. He will be leading our discussion with our operational partners as well as moderating the Q&A at the end. And he is the director of HSR&D's Evidence-Based Synthesis Program Coordinating Center located at Portland, Oregon VA Medical Center. He's also a professor of medicine and general internal medicine at the Department of Medical Informatics and Clinical Epidemiology at Oregon Health and Sciences University School of Medicine, also in Portland, Oregon. Our operational partners today that are going to be joining us as discussants, we have Dr. Jason Dominance. He's the National Program Director for Gastroenterology for the Department of Veterans Affairs, Acting GI Section Chief at VA Puget Sound Healthcare System in Washington, and Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. And finally, we have Dr. Art Wallace joining us. He's the Chief of Anesthesiology Service in the San Francisco VA Medical Center and a Professor of Anesthesia and Perioperative Medicine at the University of California in San Francisco. I appreciate everyone joining us today. And at this time, Dr. Shaukat, are you ready to share your screen?
I am.
Excellent. There we go.
All right. Good afternoon or good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining our ESB cyber seminar today. I'd like to start by acknowledging our co-authors, collaborators, and other individuals that were instrumental in preparing this report. You can see the topic nominators, stakeholders, and expert panels with representation from anesthesia and GI, and these individuals were critical in giving us guidance, feedback, in shaping the report, and giving us feedback as the report went by. So I'd like to thank all these individuals. Just in ways of disclosure, none of the investigators on the report today have any affiliations or financial involvements that conflict with the material that will be presented in today's report. A word on the VA ESP program. This program is sponsored by the VA Office of Research and Development and Quality Enhancement Research Initiative, or QERI, and this program is established to provide timely and accurate synthesis of reviews of healthcare topics. The idea is these are questions that are important to clinical practice and relevant to veterans, and the topics can be nominated by anybody throughout the VA, and they go through a vetting process, and here's the website that provides more information on topic selection. This slide just outlines the process of ESP report synthesis. It goes through a steering committee. There's a technical expert panel, external peer reviewers, and other policy partners. And there's reviews and comments on the draft reports. And then the final report is posted on the website and disseminated. So this brings me to our current report and topic for today, which is colonoscopy outcomes by duration of NPO status prior to colonoscopy with moderate or deep sedation. And you can see the full-length report on the ESP website. Link is provided. So by ways of background, 14 million colonoscopies are performed in the U.S. annually. Colonoscopies require bowel preparation for cleansing and to be able to sufficiently visualize the colonic lining during the exam. To maximize cleansing, bowel preparation is generally split into two sessions, and this is referred to as a split dose, where half the dose is given the evening prior to the colonoscopy and half the dose is given morning of the colonoscopy, several hours prior to the colonoscopy. And then typically some level of sedation, which is typically moderate sedation, is used during the colonoscopy. Now, a goal recently set by the U.S. Multi-Society Task Force on Colon Cancer Screening is that 85% or more of colonoscopies should have an adequate preparation. And this is to make clinics and systems evaluate their process for meeting this benchmark. Monitoring of preparation quality is recommended by the most recent VHA Colon Cancer Screening Directive, which was released in December 2014. So the VA acknowledges that preparation quality is highly important and should be monitored. And then most recent GI multi-society guidelines recommend using a split preparation with the last dose of the purgative given 2 to 4 hours prior to the colonoscopy. Practice guidelines from the American Society of Anesthesiologists Committee on Standards and Practice Parameters for preoperative fasting for healthy patients undergoing elective procedures suggests the following minimum fasting periods with the goal of minimizing anesthesia-related risks, primarily aspiration. They recommend 2 hours of NPO for clear liquids such as water, fruit juices, 6 hours for milk, and 6 hours of NPO after a light meal, such as toast or clear liquids. So an optimal bowel preparation and NPO status seeks to balance two things: need for optimal colonic preparation, patient convenience, scheduling efficiency, typically a shorter NPO window status, with the safety of the procedure and any anesthesia concerns for a elective procedure, and which would typically require a longer NPO status. So that brings us to our study aims, which was to review the evidence on relationship between timing of NPO and incidence of aspiration, other anesthesia-related harms, and also on colonoscopy outcomes. These are our key questions, which were developed as part of this report. The first key question was, does the incidence of aspiration and other anesthesia-related harms for colonoscopy vary by NPO status or bowel prep timing? Our second key question was, what is the effect of variable timing of bowel preparation and NPO status on the quality of the bowel prep, the colonoscopy outcomes such as diagnostic yield, and other quality indicators such as completion rates, adenoma detection rates, total procedure time, fecal intubation time, and withdrawal time? Key question three was, what is the effect of NPO status prior to colonoscopy on resource use, such as costs, unused procedural slots, delays in rescheduling, delays in diagnosis, increased volume of procedure, scheduling and nursing time associated with canceled or delayed procedures? And key question four was, what is the effect of bowel preparation and NPO status on patient adherence to bowel prep, such as rescheduled colonoscopies, patient satisfaction with bowel preparation and or colonoscopy? So our PCOTs, the population we considered was adults undergoing bowel preparation for elective colonoscopy with moderate or deep sedation. Interventions were NPO status of 2 to 4 hours, NPO, and this could either be that liquids or bowel preparation was allowed up to 2 hours prior to the procedure. This was compared to any alternative or longer timing of NPO status. And our outcomes, as mentioned, were aspiration events, rescheduled colonoscopies, and secondary events of adverse events and outcomes of colonoscopy, including quality indicators. We considered quality of bowel prep as an intermediate outcome, as well as a whole host of other intermediate outcomes. And the timing was from start of sedation for colonoscopy to completion of sedation for colonoscopy. We did not include studies where there was an aspiration event while taking the preparation prior to colonoscopy. And the setting was either inpatient or outpatient clinics. researched Medline for articles published between 1990 through October 2014, and we included studies of any study design that gave any information on duration of NPO. Studies were limited to human subjects published in English, and we also searched references of guidelines, existing reviews, as well as references we received from stakeholders and our expert panel members. We used objective criteria for assessment of risk of bias for both randomized controlled trials and observational studies. And based on this, individual studies were rated as low, moderate, or high risk of bias. We rated the evidence based on published criteria. Overall strength of evidence was rated as insufficient, low, moderate, or high. And separate ratings were provided for randomized controlled trials and observational studies. So here's our literature flowchart. Our initial search yielded 1,177 references. About 1,000 were excluded at the abstract level. We reviewed 108 full text reviews. Many were excluded for the reasons listed. And then we also, based on our hand search and references provided by experts, were able to add several other references. So in total, we included 40 studies, 28 randomized control trials, 2 case control trials, and 10 observational studies. So this just shows characteristics of the included studies. A total of 22,000 patients were evaluated, and most of these studies were from the U.S. and Canada. Mean age was 57, and most of these studies reported on colonoscopies as being screening colonoscopies. And this shows the minimum time of NPO that was reported, and this illustrates that about 27 studies reported NPOs of 4 hours or shorter, and this could either be NPO after intake of preparation or NPO for liquid. And here are some of our results. So for key question one, risk of aspiration, we found 6 studies that reported on aspiration. The studies varied from 136 to 1,300 individuals. 2 were low risk of bias, 4 were deemed moderate risk of bias, 5 of 6 reported no aspiration events. 1 low risk of bias RCT with 125 participants reported 1 aspiration event that required hospitalization during colonoscopy under moderate sedation. And this particular individual was a male, obese patient who was assigned to consume half of the prep 4 hours before the colonoscopy. So in summary, shorter duration of NPO is not associated with higher incidence rate of aspiration. We found low strength evidence. Regarding our co-primary outcome, rescheduled colonoscopies, we found 1 moderate risk of bias randomized controlled trial with 113 participants, and rate of rescheduled colonoscopies was 3% in the group that completed the preparation in morning before the colonoscopy, and it was 3 and 8 times higher at about 8% and 24% in the group that completed preparation quality the night before. Based on this, we found insufficient strength of evidence that shorter duration of NPO is associated with lower rate of rescheduled colonoscopies. In terms of other harms, there were 7 studies, 6 with moderate risk of bias, 1 with low risk of bias, that reported on other harms. 4 studies reported no adverse events. 3 studies reported adverse events to the magnitude of about 1% of the procedures, and these were varied, but they were included things such as lower GI bleeding, an MI, episode of pancreatitis, and an episode of non-cardiac chest pain, and none of them were occurred in the group that were that received the shorter duration of NPO. Regarding NPO status and gastric volume, there were two studies that were included with 141 and 712 participants, one low risk of bias, one moderate risk of bias studies, where tandem EGDs were performed on individuals that had prepped for colonoscopy at the time of colonoscopy. And in the one study, comparing NPO of 1.5 hours prior to colonoscopy versus an overnight NPO, the gastric volume was similar. In the other study, reporting a two-hour NPO prior to colonoscopy versus day before NPO also reported similar gastric volume. And this is one of the studies that I just highlighted. And you can see the study had three groups. There was a control group, which was which were individuals that underwent endoscopy only, and they were NPO after midnight. The second group had their colonoscopy preparation evening before, and the third group had a split dose preparation with the last dose given 2 hours before the colonoscopy, and the gastric volumes were very similar. This slide summarizes hospital or population-based studies on aspiration risk during colonoscopy as reported in the literature, and there are three studies, large studies here highlighted for you. That report on the overall risk of aspiration for elective colonoscopies. The first one is a study in 165,000 Medicare patients, and the other two studies are from Australia and Italy, respectively. And the rate of aspiration for colonoscopy reported in these studies ranges from about 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 100,000. As you can see, in two of these studies, the duration of NPO prior to these colonoscopies was not reported. And the third study reported that they allowed clear liquids up to 2 hours before the procedure. Regarding our key question two, colonoscopy outcomes, we've evaluated 39 studies, 28 RCTs, two case control studies, and 9 observational studies for some of these outcomes. These studies used a variety of different rating scales to rate the quality of the preparation. Quality of preparation was consistently rated higher for NPO intervals of 6 hours or less compared to intervals of more than 8 hours. However, our study focus was these secondary outcomes, which is completion rate, diagnostic yield, adenoma detection rate, procedure times, and withdrawal times. So regarding adenoma detection rate, we included 7 studies, and the results were mixed. 4 reported similar ADRs, adenoma detection rates, in the 2 NPO groups. 2 reported higher adenoma detection rates in the group with shorter NPO, 4 hours and 5 to 9 hour NPO compared to the evening prior, respectively. And 1 study where the NPO was 4 hours in both groups found higher adenoma detection rate in the group that received morning-only preparation. So this slide is a forest plot that summarizes evidence that we found for completion rates, adenoma detection rates, and diagnostic yield from the randomized controlled trials that met our eligibility criteria. So the first outcome you can see is completion rate, and you can see that we did not find a difference between in duration of NPO and rates of completion. Regarding adenoma detection rate, the one RCT also did not show a difference in adenoma detection rate between shorter and longer NPO. And also for diagnostic yield, we did not find a difference in diagnostic yield between a shorter and a longer NPO. And these are the same three outcomes, but data from observational studies that we included. And you can see from observational studies, there was suggestion that the completion rate is higher with a shorter NPO, and also adenoma detection rate was higher when the NPO was shorter. And there's 3 studies included in that. And you can see the overall estimate as represented by this, the black diamond on the screen. For our key question three, which is NPO status and resource use, so we found no studies that reported resource use, and we searched pretty broadly for resource use as any study that commented on costs, unused procedural slots, delays in rescheduling, delays in diagnosis, increased volume of procedures, scheduler or nursing time associated with canceled or delayed procedures. Although some studies did report that inadequate bowel preparation quality led to canceled procedures, they did not report whether the colonoscopy was repeated. Regarding key question four, which is patient adherence, there were no consistent findings for adherence. Four RCTs suggested better adherence to bowel prep with split dose versus the day before, whereas three RCTs showed similar adherence with split dose versus same day preparation. Regarding patient satisfaction, this was also key question four. We extracted information on elements of satisfaction that would be impacted by different schedules for bowel preparation. So we included work or school time lost, and there were five RCTs that addressed this question. Three reported fewer hours of work lost with split dose versus day before preparation. Two studies reported that the groups were similar in their reported work or school time lost. So the results were somewhat mixed. Regarding sleep disturbances, there were seven randomized controlled trials and one observational study that were included. And again, the results were somewhat mixed. Three found that there were less disturbance in sleep with the split dose preparation, whereas five found that the groups were similar in terms of sleep disturbance. So to summarize, hospital or population-based studies have reported the risk of aspiration requiring hospitalization during colonoscopy is low, 1 in 1,000 or lower. Duration of NPO in these studies was unknown. In three randomized controlled trials and two observational studies totaling of 2,300 patients, comparing shorter NPO status to NPO status of 8 hours or longer, no aspiration events were reported. It's important to note that bowel preparation was completed at least 2 hours prior in two studies and at least 3 hours in one study. Clear liquids were allowed up to 3 hours prior in one of the studies, and the final study only reported that bowel preparation was completed in the morning for an afternoon colonoscopy. 20 of 24 studies reported that time from completion of the preparation to colonoscopy of 1 to 6 hours is associated with greater quality of bowel preparation than time intervals that were longer than 8 hours. One small randomized controlled trial reported a significantly lower percentage of rescheduled colonoscopies in the split dose group compared to the evening before group. And no studies reported on other resource use outcomes, including unused procedure slots or increased volume of procedures by NPO status. Results were mixed for diagnostic yield, completion rates, and adenoma detection rate, with no consistent findings based on NPO status. And results were also mixed for time lost from work, sleep disruption, with no consistent findings based on NPO status. And here is a summary of the different outcomes that were studied in our key questions and the strength of evidence behind some of the outcomes. So we need systematically performed studies that assess duration of NPO status in relation to timing of colonoscopy and recording serious adverse events such as aspirations requiring hospitalization. Special populations at higher risk of aspiration and other anesthesia-related harms would be of particular interest, such as elderly patients, those with higher comorbidities, disabilities, and other factors that limit their ability to follow instructions and complete the preparation. We need evidence-based multi-society consensus guidelines that bring together patient representatives and members from anesthesia, gastroenterology, and other related medical specialties to really come to a consensus on what constitutes best practice. And some of these things can be done through setting up prospective registries of veterans undergoing colonoscopy. And future efforts should truly be directed towards developing standard methods to collect this information. And that concludes our ESP report. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shalcott. That was great. At this time, before we get to questions from the audience, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Helfand, and he'll be guiding the discussion with our operational partners, Dr. Wallace and Dr. Dominance. Over to you, Mark.
Hello?
Yep, you're coming through.
Okay. I just want to check to see who wants to go first. I suppose we could start with Dr. Wallace or Dr. Dominance. Jason, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. Do you want to give us a do you want to say a few words first on the context for this and any other observations you want to make?
Sure. I'll try to be brief. So this is a really important topic. There are about 14 million colonoscopies performed every year in the United States, about 300,000 done among VA patients, about 200,000 of those are done in the VA, and about 100,000 done through fee basis. And we need to be very pragmatic about this issue. Split-dose PrEP is the standard of care and is being used worldwide. There are FDA-approved regimens for split-dose bowel PrEP. And the risk of an inadequate bowel PrEP is something that is of considerable consequence. You know, Dr. Shalcott reviewed some of the information. Unfortunately, the evidence around some of these issues is limited. The randomized controlled trials of adenoma detection rate based on short versus longer MPO status was on very, very small studies. And the adenoma detection rate is an incomplete measure of colonoscopy quality. All you have to do is find one adenoma to determine the adenoma detection rate. There's other quality measures that have been proposed, like the ADR plus. It looks at the total number of adenomas. We know that we have about 140,000 colon cancers diagnosed each year, and about 5% of the colon cancers that are diagnosed are what are called interval cancers, meaning they occur after a colonoscopy. And so it's thought that about half of the colon cancers that are interval cancers are lesions that were missed during colonoscopy. How many of those were missed due to an inadequate bowel PrEP? We have no idea at this time. But when you have a bad bowel PrEP, you repeat the procedure, which exposes the patient to another round of sedation, another pushing of the scope through the colon. So the risks go up. And the risk of serious complications with colonoscopy from a meta-analysis are 2.8 per thousand. That's a pretty big number. So we want to minimize the number of times we put people through colonoscopy. The studies of gastric volume are very reassuring. Gastric emptying of liquids is quite effective. And, aspiration events occur despite long NPO status. We really don't know if the risk of aspiration events increases with a two-hour NPO status, but at this point, we have no evidence that it does. So we need to be thoughtful doctors who make medical decisions and counsel our patients. And for me, I think that the use of split-dose PrEP and short MPO status is important. And one of the really challenging things, I don't think I missed the very beginning of the presentation, I think, but if you look at the survey, an informal survey that's reported in the full ESP report, there's wide variability across anesthesiologists on how they handle this MPO status. And what does that mean for us? Well, practically what it means is that we go to the least common denominator. If there's one anesthesiologist who says you need 6 hours of MPO and the other 10 anesthesiologists say 2 hours is fine, we have to go with the 6 hour because we don't know who's going to be the anesthesiologist on the case. And so everybody gets treated at the least common denominator. Otherwise, cases get canceled. And I know I have, we know that cases are being canceled, which means patients are being exposed to bowel PrEP for no reason. No good reason, because those cases get canceled and all the inconvenience that goes with that and the wasted resources. So although there's no studies on wasted resources, I'm sure we all have anecdotal experience that there's considerable wasted resources for this kind of issue.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Wallace, do you have some general observations before we get to sort of specific questions for all of you?
Dr. Wallace, you're on the phone with us, correct? Give me just 1 second. We need to get him his audio pin. So, Dr. Wallace, if you can type.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. Thank you very much for allowing me to talk on this subject. One of the things I found about this subject was that there were enormous number of people who wanted to send in emails and talk about it, and there's a controversy back and forth. And one of the things that the anesthesiologists are very concerned about is the risk of aspiration. And we had a long discussion about the risk of aspiration. And when we started this evaluation, I decided to do a survey to see what the views were in the VA of what the NPO status should be. And what you found was that about a quarter of people thought that you should have a two-hour NPO status, and a quarter thought it should be somewhere in between, and a quarter didn't have an opinion, and some people thought that 6 to 8 hours was reasonable. And it's gone around and around and around. And I've had a number of people say to me, you know, when you look at the FDA status or criteria for this drug, the NPO is overnight. And when you talk to, I talked to someone this morning who said, you know, this drug isn't even approved by the manufacturer for use on the, in a split dose preparation. So there's a lot of controversy that's gone around, and I've had people this morning call me to tell me that it's not approved for split dose preparation. So there's a lot of controversy, and it's interesting that in this review, what you find is that we don't really have definitive evidence that the split dose is dramatically better, and we don't have definitive evidence that you have a risk of aspiration. But I know that there's an enormous amount of emotion about this topic because aspiration is a very serious problem. The other thing is when you look at an aspiration rate of 1 in 1,000, to a gastroenterologist, that's a low number. To an anesthesiologist, that's a high number. The risk of aspiration for normal cases is something like 1 in 20,000. So 1 in 1,000 is a number that is concerning to an anesthesiologist. And so I was disappointed that the ESP was not able to find definitive evidence that this was better, and I was also disappointed to find that it wasn't that there wasn't clarity at the end of it. But I think what you're finding is that evidence-based medicine is difficult to do, and there's going to be controversy after this report because we didn't end up with a definitive answer. I will yield to the next person.
Well, the next person is me for a second here to ask another question of you, Dr. Wallace. You know, there was also a survey that was published in the journal Gastroenterology Research and Practice, and this is a paper by Deepak Agrawal and colleagues, and they just surveyed anesthesiologists and gastroenterologists, about 100 each. And, of course, there were big differences in how long people should wait, you know, until sedation as far as fluids. But what I found, what I want to pull out of this is that the main reason anesthesiologists in that survey objected to shorter waiting times was that they didn't consider polyethylene glycol a clear liquid. And this seems to be, and I should say this is the very first question that an audience member for this cyber seminar just posed. So it's I think a very representative thing. Could you comment on the concerns about sort of aspiration of polyethylene glycol versus a general clear liquids period for prior to the procedure?
This is a very important issue in that the clear liquid rules are for clear liquids, which are
maybe juice that's clear, and the volumes are considered small volumes. You know, they're 8 ounces or less. Now, the prep that you're using for a colonoscopy is at least a liter, and it has ethylene glycol in it. And ethylene glycol, when you aspirate it, causes pneumonitis and a very severe ARDS-type reaction. So this is not a clear liquid to an anesthesiologist. It may be clear in that you can see through it, but it's not a benign fluid that if you aspirated it, it would cause no injury. And so there's a lot of concern about, you know, drinking a liter of fluid 2 hours before, and that fluid, if you actually aspirated it, would cause pneumonitis and death. Now, let's think about another comparison to this. When you say, what's the 1 in 1,000 event rate? The event rate for general anesthesia for obstetrical cases is considered a big issue, and people really worry about aspiration in obstetrical cases because the women have a full stomach and they have a high incidence of nausea. And the event rate for mask anesthesia for an obstetrical case is about 1 in 200. Now, no one would ever provide mask anesthesia for general anesthesia for a woman at term because the 1 in 200 event rate is considered a catastrophic event and too high a rate. So 1 in 1,000 to an anesthesiologist is a very high event rate. And I think that's the problem you're seeing, that you're giving someone a liter of fluid that can cause aspiration pneumonitis, and the event rate is a number you can measure, like 1 in 1,000, and to us, that's a big deal.
This is Jason Dominitz from GI. Can I comment? I don't think we know what the event rate is with this. The 1 in 1,000 is coming from the Medicare population from a database study where we don't know the NPO status. We don't know if these aspiration events are truly related to these procedures or not. You know, there are tremendous volumes of split-dose prep being done. And, you know, we're not hearing about this. It doesn't mean that it's not happening, and so further research is certainly welcome. But, I'm at a VA right now in the middle of the country that's been using in-house bowel prep, where they administer the bowel prep before the colonoscopy in the procedure room and finish 2 hours before. And they've had no known aspiration events, but they're going to go look at it now because we're talking about this. And they've been doing this for 20 years. So they were quite surprised to hear this number of 1 in 1,000 because they do 3,000 or 4,000 procedures a year at this institution, 3,000 or 4,000 colonoscopies. So we really don't know. I mean, I think we have to be careful about using this 1 in 1,000 number. Also, the bowel prep is being completed at least 2 hours beforehand, not being drunk at 2 hours. So it's typically, you know, in the 3 to 4 hour range that they're starting to drink that additional bowel prep. And if you look at gastric emptying, the stomach is very effective at emptying liquids, and that's why we're only seeing 20 mils of fluid in the stomach. And it may not be anything. It may not be any of the colite that's in those 20 mils. It may be purely gastric secretions and saliva. So, you know, I think there's a lot of unknowns here. And so we have to be very careful about making assumptions about this. And the FDA approval, some of the bowel preps are FDA approved for split dose. And as we all know, once a company gets FDA approved for a certain regimen, they're not going to go back and spend the money on getting FDA approval for a different regimen. So we have to be honest about this, intellectually honest about this. FDA approval does exist for split dose preps. We can't keep outing this lack of FDA approval.
As someone who has done a number of trials, what I've learned about event rates is that people are really lousy at writing down events. And we did a number of studies in strokes in cardiac surgery, and people would say, this never, ever, ever occurs. And then you would say, well, here's the event rate. We did the neurocog test before and after. We did NI stroke scales before and after. And unless people are looking for events, they're really terrible at identifying them, recording them, publishing them. They occur, and I think you have to be careful that someone says, well, we've never seen this happen. My reaction to that is, well, did you look? And frequently people haven't really looked.
Well, and that's why I said they're going to go back and look at it now, and that is important. You're absolutely right.
I think everyone, certainly the three speakers, including Dr. Shaka, you know, I think everyone agrees that a lot of this discussion is about sort of the evidence not being where we'd like it to be, and sort of in a way we're formulating or thinking about you know, the ideal study, or the study, even if it's not ideal, that would answer some of these questions. And I wanted to summarize where we are just so far in the conversation. First of all, everybody has focused a bit on this issue of aspiration as an outcome. One thing that I noticed in the report is that it's talking about aspiration requiring hospitalization. If you were designing the next study, though, an outcome defined as something like aspiration requiring hospitalization can be hard to ascertain. That is, somebody could have a procedure, not aspirate dramatically at the moment enough to be hospitalized later, and then there is some doubt because of other illnesses or other things going on about the cause of the aspiration or what to say about it. And so the other aspect that's come up in the conversation so far is, you know, the consequence or severity of aspiration. This gets at the issue of whether aspiration of a clear liquid and aspiration of polyethylene glycol is any different. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is that when we say, or Jason, when you say they're going to look at their data, there's only been a few thousand patients in the studies to date that the review talked about. There's hundreds, as you mentioned, hundreds of thousands of colonoscopies. How feasible is it to quickly get a handle on on the actual rate of hospitalizations after colonoscopy, and maybe how many are attributable and how severe they are?
Yeah, I think it's quite doable. In fact, you know, I don't know if there's anybody on this call who wants to do that study, but I've been thinking about doing a study using the corporate data warehouse. We have to identify outpatient colonoscopies and then see how many of them end up being admitted and for what reason. And with 200,000 procedures per year, it's relatively easy. What's not easy is determining.
We have already started doing that in San Francisco because we think it's important to get a real number. So we're starting to do the analysis.
Right. Well, what's not easy is determining the NPO status of the individual patients. That information is not recorded in a systematic fashion. So it would require chart review, and even that may not document the actual duration of NPO status. So as a surrogate, you could potentially identify facilities that by protocol, you split dose versus those that don't and see if there are differences.
Our plan is to survey the facilities to get the NPO status and then see if we can see an association between their stated NPO guidelines and the event rate.
Great. That would be very interesting information.
Yeah. So, Dr. Wallace, I want to turn this last issue, I don't want to leave this issue of polyethylene glycol because, as I said, it seems to be so much of a concern. Does that mean, conversely, that, you know, and I'm not trying to get ahead of ourselves here as a sort of a system, but does that mean there'd be much less concern with the two-day split-dose regimens for the low-volume preps? You know, the things like sodium picosulfate, magnesium citrate, those kinds of preps. Does that mean that a lot of this concern would go away?
It depends what's in the material. I mean, if the way people try this out is they take an animal and they squirt it into the lungs of an animal and they say, does this cause pneumonitis or ARDS? And I haven't looked at the literature for these other preps, but that's the standard approach, is to squirt it into the lung of a test animal and see what happens. And, you know, the anesthesiologists think about what the pH is, what the volume is, what's in the material, and you would need to look at these other agents to see if they're safer.
And if I can speak on behalf of GI, obviously nobody in GI wants a patient to have an aspiration. We have, this doesn't, make our lives any better to have patients have aspiration. And the NPO duration doesn't directly make our lives easier or harder. What it makes the difference in is the quality of the bowel preparation. There's high quality evidence that bowel preparation is better with shorter duration.
Well, I was, before you push that on, I mean, the ESP didn't really conclude that, which is kind of shocking to me, because everyone says it's much better, but it's the evidence from the ESP was that it was hard to show it was a lot better.
It was better in terms of bowel prep quality ratings, but they did the studies looking at other outcomes like adenoma detection rate or cancer rate, there was very limited evidence on that. There were only very, very small randomized control trials. Observational studies showed a benefit in ADR, but the randomized control trials were very small. Asma, correct me if I'm wrong. So
bowel quality
using scales shows a dramatic difference, but more further outcomes have not been well studied. Is that a fair assessment, Asma?
Yes, that's a fair assessment. There were very few studies that looked at hard outcomes. A large body of evidence suggesting that shorter duration of NPO is associated with higher quality of bowel preparation. However, the studies had not done the next step, which is look at outcomes of colonoscopy, such as completion rates, diagnostic yield, adenoma detection rates.
And it's important.
I think I'm going to ask the thing you were maybe about to answer, Jason, or Asma, you can answer as well. It's a little surprising. I don't want to put this question in a confrontational way, but the GI guidelines that you cited early on in one of the early slides, they gave the impression, I read them a couple days ago, and you know, they gave the impression that the evidence about diagnostic lead and yield and completion rates and so on was stronger than it came out in your report. I guess what I would think about this, and Jason, this may be what you should comment on. If something's that obvious, that is, if something is, you know, even though there's only sort of thin or anecdotal evidence, seems self-evident almost, that procedures are being canceled, that completion rates are not what they should be, that a number of people are being subjected to more than one procedure, or are being delayed more than we think is safe in order to get their second procedure. If all those things are really at the level that we can see them with our own eyes without a study, it should be quite easy to find out in a study how big they are. And so I guess my question is, how did that happen? Why is it that the studies haven't been able to demonstrate this, and what's the next step on that?
So I don't know that I can give the definitive answer. I'll give you my opinion, which is that there's a lot of studies on bowel prep, dozens and dozens and dozens of them, and they typically have about 100 or 200 patients per treatment arm. And they're designed by drug companies that are trying to show that their regimen is better than another one. And they want to do the smallest study possible to show a difference in their bowel prep regimen versus another one, and they use an outcome that they can measure that on, which is these bowel prep quality scores. And so they don't use it to adenoma detection rate or cancer detection or diagnostic yield, because that has a lot of variability in it that's harder to measure. They'd have to have a bigger study design. So I think it's really an issue of who's paying for the study that defines it. But that's my opinion. I don't have any evidence other than my experience to base that on.
Absolutely. I'd like to add that, so Mark, we found, as I mentioned, large number of studies with the outcome of having a higher quality of bowel preparation. At the same time, there's a large number of studies that suggested that higher quality of bowel preparation led to higher adenoma detection rate, diagnostic yield, completion rates, but we weren't able to include any of those studies because they didn't have information on timing of NPO. So the GI community has taken that as indirect evidence that the outcomes of studies are kind of broken up into, you know, two different sets, and taken together, it suggests that shorter NPO improves these outcomes, but there were very few studies that looked at the direct association of the two.
Yeah, I think is it the transitive property of mathematics? You know, if it's A is better than B and B is better than C, then A is better than C. I think that's what we're doing in GI.
Right.
The problem with that in evidence-based medicine is that it's not sufficient, and that there are lots of studies where the logic makes complete sense, and I love logic, and logic is great, and then you do the study, and you find that it doesn't work. So the transitive property of logic is a wonderful thing. It's just not sufficient in evidence-based medicine.
Oh, yeah, there are a number of studies that have looked at interval cancers, and interval cancers are what we're worried about. So as I said, it's about 5% of all cancers are interval cancers, and one of the strongest predictors of interval cancers is a suboptimal bowel prep. And we know that suboptimal bowel preps are associated with longer NPO status. So, you know, as I was saying earlier, you know, the GI community does not want aspiration events. We really don't. And so, you know, if there is evidence that the shorter NPO status was increasing the risk of aspiration, then I think you would see the GI community endorsing longer NPO status times. But right now, without that evidence, and with the evidence that we do have, we are worried about missing cancers. We are worried about making patients go through a second procedure. And that's why I am passionate about this issue. I completely understand the anesthesia perspective on this. And, you know, we don't want patients to be harmed, but they can be harmed by a longer NPO status, and it's important to balance these issues together.
There's a, I think, people listening to this who want to know, you know, how can this be resolved? I was actually struck by your comment earlier, Jason, that just on a practical level, if you're trying to schedule people, and there's several different practice styles of anesthesiologists, some of whom want a longer period of NPO, and others who don't, you have to schedule to, you know, you can't really. You could end up with a canceled case if you don't know who's going to be assigned. So that it could be difficult, really, to see it, to assume that the policy at some place is really what's being done, as long as somebody disagrees with the policy. And so as far as giving our the folks listening an idea of what could be done next, in addition to more studies, the report suggested, working on guidance. I think that indirectly or directly, you two may also be suggesting some kind of guidance process with the evidence we have while we're trying to collect more. And so I'll start with you, Dr. Wallace. What do you see as a way forward on this issue?
Well, the first thing you find is that guidance documents are supposed to be based on level one evidence, and you don't really have that. Then you turn around and you say, well, okay, we're going to have to somehow go from the current state, which is a giant hodgepodge of different rules and different people having different rules, to something more consistent. And my opinion about the way you do that is you change the culture slowly and you prove that what you're suggesting is safe. And so what I suggest we do is we do some epidemiology to look at what the real event rate of aspiration is in the VA, and we look at whether there's an association with NPO time, and then we say, okay, let's shift the NPO time from the 6 hours that many, many, many people think it is now down to 4 hours. See if anything happens, and then if nothing happens, shift it to 3 and then shift it to 2. And I suggested this to our gastroenterologist a couple of years ago, and they didn't want to do that. And because they didn't want to do that, we have now gone through 3 or 4 more years of having this variable GI NPO rate. So I think that the way you change a culture is you provide good evidence for what's safe. You provide legal protection to people who are changing what you're doing. And then you shift the culture by doing it slowly. And you say, okay, let's try 4 and then let's try 2. And what you'll find if you do this for a couple of years is that you'll quickly be down to two hours and people will be comfortable doing it. But if you don't do that, 4 or 5 years from now, we'll still have this hodgepodge with variable timing for NPO status.
I mean, it's a tough situation, Art. And offline, I can tell you where the site is that has been using 2 hours for 20 years now. And maybe you can look at their data, and maybe that will help you. You know, if we go to 4 hours, what would happen to the sites that are using 2 now? It is quite variable across the VA, and this is not just a VA issue. There are some private sector facilities that are going through the exact same thing.
But more than 80% of the VA thinks that it has a 6-hour NPO status right now. When you because I polled them to find out what it is, and if you want to shift it over, you've got to provide people the legal cover to do it, and you've got to provide the structure to do it, and you've got to reassure them that it's safe, and you've got to show the event rates. And it's very easy to show event rates now. We can do the epidemiology and show that, but you do have to put in the effort to do it to reassure people that what they're doing is safe.
Yeah, we'd have to carefully craft policy that allows, you know, that might maybe goes to 4 hours but doesn't disallow a 2-hour NPO status. If we disallowed 2 hours, that would be problematic.
Well, no, I'm saying, you know, move the curve slowly.
Right. So I'm going to amplify on move the curve slowly. I think that the moving the curve in the manner that you suggest or moving it in another manner, like something more quicker. Either way, it seems to me the key ingredient is a data-driven environment. That is, not doing something for years and years and not being and still not know what its effects are. And so, in addition to the will to try as an organization to test the waters on different strategies. You know, the situation we apparently have had, where we're not measuring the things that people really care about as far as the impact of different policies, that seems to have to change. That is, we have to, right now, and I sort of heard a couple of instances where people say, yeah, we're going to look at our data, but in a continuous data environment, you know, signals pop out at you if anything happens. That's the environment that permits that kind of change. And so, I'm sorry.
We are supposed to be a learning organization, and we are supposed to be using our informatics system to improve the quality of care. And the VA Anesthesia Service would very much like and is working to set up a nationwide VA quality improvement program to be able to give you data like this to improve systems over time, know what the real event rates are, and make the VA really into a learning organization. And I think this is important. We applied for a grant this year to support this, and it wasn't funded, but I think the VA really needs to do this if you want to improve care, improve access, and improve quality. I mean, that's how people do it in the modern age. They analyze their data, they make intelligent decisions, they watch what's happening, and you improve the system over time.
And, I fully support that. We're trying to get better data systems for endoscopy. We don't have a data system for endoscopy in the VA right now. We have a hodgepodge of ways people complete endoscopy reports, and I've been pushing for something along the lines of CART, which is used in cardiology, people may be aware of, so that we can get higher quality colonoscopy data and other endoscopy data. And, of course, if we did that, it would be possible to have a field for how long somebody was NPO, and then we'd be able to link that information with outcomes data.
And so I feel we're about out of time. Is that correct? We have 1 minute left. Is there a moderator?
Yes.
Yes. I did want to expand a little bit before we conclude and say, in this data system, or ask, I should say, in this data system, Dr. Wallace, if you could address this, you know, what is the role of the type of the depth and the type of sedation in this? Is this an issue? I noticed that the report had focused on moderate, mostly the studies focused on moderate sedation. But is there anything from the anesthesia side where there might be practices that vary that could also be important to look at in this in monitoring how we're doing here?
much to my surprise, there are places that do colonoscopy without sedation. You know, if you do it without sedation, the aspiration is a lower probability event. There also are different approaches depending on whether you're using sedasis or you're using narcotics, you know, how long people are asleep for. So the type of sedation matters, the depth of sedation matters, how long people are rendered so they're not good at protecting their airway matters. And that's a difficult thing to capture in an epidemiologic study. But all of those things matter in how long people are at risk of aspiration.
Thank you. And so we're concluding. I want to thank all of the speakers and all the listeners and those who submitted questions. And is there a final word that you need to give us?
Yes. Thank you so much to all of our panelists and presenters for joining us and for our audience members. And I am going to shut down the meeting in just a second. And there is going to be a feedback survey that pops up on your screen. So please take just a moment to fill out those few questions. We look very closely at your responses, and it helps us improve sessions already given, as well as ideas for new sessions to support. So thank you once again to everyone. And this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar presentation. Have a great day.